Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined by Lahav Harkov. Lahav, you just got back from the land of whiskey and kilts. You were there with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and the largest Israeli delegation ever to a climate conference, maybe the largest to this climate conference, no?
It's not so clear because we don't really have a comparative list. Israel did have an unusually large delegation, but a lot of the reporting on this has been misleading. Basically, Israel did something different from other countries, which is that, so Prime Minister Bennett's...
Of course. Why would we do what everyone else does?
Right. But no, but Bennett's focus has been on Israeli innovation and pushing Israeli, you know, tech industry as a way to find solutions for climate change. And so Israel helped a lot of people involved in those kinds of things get their credentials for the conference. So even though the government didn't pay the way of private businesses to fly to Glasgow and whatever,
they were part of the official delegation.
Right. So all this reporting, oh, Israel has 130 people in the delegation, and why do we have so many more people than other countries, and is it wasteful, is it corrupt, is a little overblown.
Lahav, you know, Israel, let's be honest for a moment. The environment or the climate has never really been at the top of this country's list of priorities, right? This is a country that always kind of rolls from one existential threat to the next. Climate change, the rising sea levels, the hotter summers, the longer winters isn't exactly what governments have a vested political interest in doing anything. I mean, what was... is Bennett really there for?
Well, so interestingly, I mean, Bennett has said a lot about climate since he came into office. He does seem to be on board with at least trying to get in line with other Western countries on this issue. And also for the first time, we have an environmental protection minister, Tamar Zandberg, who I interview in this week's episode. You know, I think this is the first time that we had someone in that position who, or at least the first time in a very long time, who was actually an activist and someone involved in environmentalism who really cares about it, rather than it being like a consolation prize for someone who couldn't get a more senior ministerial post.
Remind us who has been minister there. It was Zev Elkin at one point, right? I mean,
Zev Elkin, Gila Gamliel, Amir Peretz.
Right.
So, you know, Gilad Erdan.
Not very passionate about the environment, but definitely Tamar Zandberg, who you speak to, is passionate about it, but you also wrote from there how Bennett was kind of using the conference and the climate as a topic to get closer to other countries, to build these relations, how he recognized how important it is for the United States, for the Europeans, for other countries, and that this could be a talking point that could build those relationships, and then through that hopefully get something on Iran or on Palestinians or whatever other big diplomatic issue, Syria, that might be coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't present it necessarily as like a quid pro quo that, like, you know, oh, we will commit to net zero carbon by 2050 and then you won't, you know, revive the Iran deal or something like that. But
Israel's carbon footprint is not that important.
Right. No, but I think this government sees it as important to sort of show that it's really aligned with the West, with liberal democracies, and caring about the climate is something that those countries have been doing for years now.
Right.
And as you said, Israel was not in line with them at all. So now Israel's kind of playing catch up, and it has a long way to go. I mean, there was a state comptroller report last week about how Israel has not really kept to any of its commitments on climate. And I think, you know, there was a lot of pressure, I would say, not in like a tense way, but the UK as host of the conference had been putting pressure on a lot of different countries to set sort of ambitious goals, and Israel was no different. And so, you know, so Israel has gotten in line with the West on this net zero carbon by 2050 promise. We're supposed to be phasing out coal by 2025, and that's something that actually Israel had committed to under Netanyahu. Not so hard for us because we have natural gas,
right?
But natural gas is still, you know, is not considered, it's a cleaner energy than coal, but it's still considered, you know, greenhouse gases. So it's not renewable energy. And so, you know, and I ask, Tamar Zandberg about this, which we'll hear later in the episode, you know, there was such excitement and enthusiasm in Israel about our natural gas findings and how much money that will save us, how it'll make us an energy superpower. But at the same time, we're committing to not using it in another 30 years. So that's a little bit strange. In one way. And it, I think it shows a lot of the tension that you see all around the world, not only in Israel, between the desire for economic growth and economic stability and the desire to do things that will not harm the environment and will mitigate the challenges of climate change. It's a really difficult dilemma. And that was really what was at the crux of this conference. That is really what I think a lot of the leaders were talking about and trying to figure out. And a big thing also, you know, developing countries, they need cheap energy and electricity in order to grow their economies, you know, and to start having industry and to modernize more. And the sort of global north, the more developed countries are telling them, no, wait, you have to slow down because you're polluting too much. And at the Paris Accords in 2015, the developed countries promised to give $100 billion a year to the developing countries to help them get cleaner without it being an economic setback. But they have been very, very far from reaching that target. So a lot of this conference was actually really about economic and financial issues.
Lahav, you know, you usually cover diplomacy and Israel's diplomatic relations, but you were at this conference, and I'm just curious, Naftali Bennett, ahead of going to Glasgow, spoke about reaching, as you mentioned, 2050 net zero emissions. How would Israel do that, right? What's the practical plan that's in place? Are we just going to based on solar energy? We got a lot of sun, of course, we know. Is that what they're talking about?
Solar energy is basically what they're talking about. But it needs to be said, right now, only 6% of Israel's energy is renewable energy. And I said I usually cover diplomacy. I feel like I really took a crash course in this in the last couple of weeks. I read a book. I've been reading a lot of articles. So anyway, Israel is at 6% renewables right now. And the problem with solar energy is that there really is not the technology to scale it up. Nobody in the world is using mostly renewable energies. And so Prime Minister Bennett said in his speech, actually, that, you know, in order for people to get to net carbon zero, they're going to have to use technology that has not been invented yet. And Bennett hopes that Israel will be at the vanguard of inventing those technologies. Now, as far as solar energy is concerned, there are companies that are working on what's called solar energy storage so that the energy can be used hours after the sun goes down. Because for now, that's something that's very difficult. It could only last a short amount of time. It can only be stored in batteries and not really used in a way that's convenient, you know, for electricity for a home. So, you know, Bennett is plans to form a committee to have a government sort of fund that will help, that will invest in green tech companies that are just getting started and to find ways to cut red tape and otherwise encourage sort of tech entrepreneurs to take on green challenges.
Right.
But the way things look now, I mean, it's hard to see
how we get there.
Exactly.
Right. Lahav, while you were there and Bennett was there, he held a ton of meetings, right? He met with Boris Johnson. He met with Modi from India. He met with the Crown Prince of Bahrain. He met with Morrison from Australia, Macron. What was going on in those meetings? Was that climate stuff or was that more, let's take advantage of this opportunity to crack at Iran, Syria, and the bigger issues that he's focused on?
So there's two different things. Bennett had seven different bilateral meetings, which were meetings that were scheduled. He sat one-on-one in a room with different leaders, the prominent of which are Johnson, Macron, and Modi. And he also met with Bill Gates, which I thought was interesting, just, you know, on that whole tech theme. And then the meetings with, you know, the members of the British royal family and some other leaders were at a reception that was hosted by Prince Charles on the first evening of the event. And, you know, these are people who he had quick 5-minute conversations with because he met them. You know, he talked with Kate Middleton, who, when I tweeted the name Kate Middleton, a bunch of people got mad at me. They said she hasn't been Middleton in a long time. But, you know, Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge is a mouthful. Anyway,
I apologize as well then.
Right. So he met with the Duchess of Cambridge, and they talked about ways to convince youth to get more involved in climate action. You know, and there's a great picture of him with Boris Johnson and President Joe Biden, where Joe Biden's making this like huge smiley face, and Bennett's like pointing at Johnson, and people should look it up because it's just like everyone's gesticulating like wildly. And I, you know, wondered what that was about. And his Bennett's spokesman said that they actually were talking about Israeli politics, and that Biden and Johnson were like asking him like, how are you going to make this crazy coalition you have work? You know, and actually it seems like, from what I saw, that Johnson and Bennett like really hit it off. Johnson seems to be someone who's very easy to get along with, at least if you're just having.
They've also, I've heard reports of how they've been WhatsApping one another for a bunch of months.
Yes, especially
COVID stuff and right. other things.
Johnson is really fascinated with what Israel's been doing with COVID. And even today, when we're recording this on Wednesday, he gave an interview to Christiane Amanpour on CNN. And he actually talked about that they want to try to model their rollout of the third booster, you know, the booster shot for COVID after what Israel did, because Israel moves so fast. So it's not just, you know, Bennett's people touting this. Johnson genuinely is interested and looks at what Israel does as a model.
But while he was there and having these bilateral meetings and maybe coordinating some moves when it comes to Iran, we heard also today that the Iranians are going to be renewing the P5+1 negotiations on the Iran deal at the end of November. Where does Israel stand on this, right? What is Bennett's position as the U.S. returns to that negotiating table and is going to try to get a deal? I mean, that's obvious, right? That Biden wants a deal. Israel also wants a deal, but it wants a better deal. Is Israel going to get a better deal?
As recently as this week, in Bennett's meetings with Johnson and Macron and other people at the COP26, at the climate conference, he was telling them that returning to the JCPOA is a bad idea, and it's going to have the exact opposite effect of what they want. So Bennett was saying that returning to the deal is a mistake, and that doing so would have the opposite effect of what they wanted, that removing sanctions is going to free up billions of dollars for Iran, and they're going to spend that on malign actions. Maybe they won't be spending it on their nuclear program. Maybe that, even that's not so sure, because we know that they've hidden things from the inspectors. But they're definitely going to spend it on drones, and drone warfare by Iran has been a real concern in the last year or so, especially. You know, and they'll spend it on proxies like, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, they're not going to be peaceful just because they stop enriching uranium at this point. And the other thing is that, you know, they've enriched uranium at such an advanced level, so far past any legitimate civilian use, and so close to a bomb, that, you know, the JCPOA is not really going to hold them back very much. And there's the fact that they have the knowledge of how to do it now and the experience, which can never be taken back. So Israel is very much against this. And Bennett told everyone he's against this, but
limited in what it can do, though.
Yes, that's the very thing, much right? So.
It's against it, but very limited.
But that's also why Bennett and Lapid are acting different than Netanyahu did, because I think they realize those limitations. They look at Netanyahu, who tried to make a huge, huge campaign and a stink about it, and they said, okay, that didn't work. So now why don't we cut our losses and try to work with our partners as best as possible, even if we don't agree on everything. And so that's sort of where things stand now.
So word about Netanyahu. As you are all hearing this podcast, it's very possible that Israel has passed its state budget, which means that the possibility of this government falling apart right now on its own is now off the table. It's still possible that one of the coalition partners will at some point at a later date pull out, but this government seems to have solidified its survival for a while. Netanyahu was kept on telling people that the government is going to fall and we'll get a defector, and maybe he will, but unlikely, it seems. So when the budget passes, and if it passes, is this going to be the end of Netanyahu? Is he going to leave? Because there are people in Likud, Nir Barkat included, who's one of the contenders, Yisrael Katz as well, who are waiting for that day that they can take over, that Netanyahu leaves. There's primaries. They run. One of them becomes the head of the Likud. This government falls apart and everyone runs into the new Likud-led government. Do you think that that's going to happen?
So I have to tell you, we stopped doing the segment tweet of the week, but there is actually a perfect tweet for what we're discussing right now, which is our colleague Gil Hoffman, the political reporter at the Jerusalem Post. He wrote that he wanted to go to the Knesset gym. And he wrote, Netanyahu has been running for more than half an hour while watching Fox News loudly. We've been waiting patiently for him to leave and give us a chance to run, but it seems he's not going anywhere anytime soon, and most of us are giving up. I think that Gil Hoffman's experience at the gym, and I'm pretty sure he wrote it that way intentionally, is a perfect metaphor for Likud, where everyone, like Nir Barkat, you talked about, Yuli Edelstein, other people, are just, Yisrael Katz, are just waiting for Netanyahu to get off of that treadmill so that they can run too. But I don't know. I don't think Netanyahu is giving up. I know there's a lot of speculation about it. And there's also talk that Larry Ellison from Oracle offered him a job. I know that there were those reports like a month or two ago. But he seems very determined. Now, you never know, right? Netanyahu, I think, is not going to like be a sad sack before he quits. He's going to try and, you know, show as strong a face as possible until the last minute. But I think, you know, he went to the Shuk Machne Yehuda in Jerusalem recently, which is like, you know, a place where there's a lot of supporters.
Right.
I think that he still thinks that he's strong and that he can do it.
Well, time will tell, and we'll see what happens when and if this budget passes. Lahav, you have an interview that you did with Tamar Zandberg, Israel's Minister of Protection of the Environment. I think I said that right. And also you did an interview with
Michael Schellenberger. He's the author of a book called Apocalypse Never, which is the case against alarmism about climate change. He believes climate change is real, it's serious, but that he thinks that certain activists and the solutions that are being presented to it are too extreme. And I started reading his book, and I thought it would be interesting to talk to him because I feel like when it comes to climate change, you just hear the same things over and over again.
Right.
Good to hear something different.
So here we go. The Jerusalem Post podcast contribution to fighting climate change. Let's begin.
Welcome, Environmental Protection Minister Tamar Zandberg, to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We were all in Glasgow for the last few days at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, and you're here to tell us a little bit about what went on there. So tell us, what do you think was Israel's sort of biggest success or achievement at this conference?
Okay, so first of all, I think that domestically, Israel's greatest success happened even before the conference started, but the conference did play a major role in our prime minister's declaration that Israel will join the effort to achieve zero net emissions by 2050. No doubt that, you know, only in last July, we adopted a governmental decision to commit to 85% reduction in emissions. And only 3 months passed. And I think this conference has been a great, you know, push for Prime Minister Bennett to declare the new targets, which I think is a very big achievement for Israel. And so that happened even before the conference started. So that already made a difference. And of course, I think Prime Minister Bennett, as you know, and he talked about it in his speech, and he talks about it all the time. He looks at the climate from the very big focus that he puts on innovation and technology. And this is the way that Israel can contribute to the global effort in ways that even exceed our size and our national emissions. And when coming to the conference and talking to representatives, then you see how big economy plays in the global effort on climate. So it's not just an environmental issue. This is basically and maybe even primarily an economic issue. Countries, funds, industries seek for new investments and new markets for climate technologies. And Israel is in a great position to be a world leader in developing these technologies, not only in startups in apps and cyber, but also in climate.
So you touched on a point that I think maybe a lot of people don't realize about this conference, that it was very focused on sort of economic and financial matters, perhaps in a way even more so than the actual, who has more emissions, what are people's targets? It's more, how are we going to pay for these targets? So, in Israel at the moment, we only have 6% renewable energy, but we have a ton of natural gas. And we just started with this great enthusiasm. I mean, not necessarily from you. You were in the opposition at the time, but we just started using this natural gas. And there was this great enthusiasm. It's going to save us so much money that we're sort of providing our own energy. What does this mean for Israel economically that we have now committed to reducing our reliance on non-renewable energy?
Mm-hmm. And then, first of all, I think that the gas resources that are now in the field, that are now in use, both for the domestic supply of the Israeli market and to the export, especially to the neighboring countries, is right now is necessary. And we have enough gas for our use and for export for the next foreseeable years. But the new commitment for net zero must mean that we do not develop new fields or new drills of oil and gas if we want to meet the target. And it means that we have to heavily invest in renewables, in solar. We have to solve a lot of bureaucracies around it. And we have to invest both in existing technology and also in new technology, in order to, to meet the targets and join the global effort.
And it does help us reach our first target, which is to get rid of coal by 2025, right?
Right, yes. We did commit and we are in the progress of stopping all coal use in 4 or 5 years, which is a huge achievement. But I think that from the days that the gas drilling started in Israel over 10 years ago, I think that the world has made a progress, and now we know the emissions that come from gas. We know the methane gas, which is a greenhouse gas. And we know that gas is also a fossil fuel and it is also, it's not renewable, the climate knowledge and science and technology is developing all the time and we have to step with it. The world does not make a distinction between oil and gas at this point. They're both fossil fuels and no question that we have to move from them to renewables if we want to meet the target, and if we want to, put our money where our mouth is, so to speak.
So aside from the coal target, Israel has not been great at keeping to its commitments when it comes to the environment. We now have a new government. We have you as Environmental Protection Minister, probably the first time that we had someone who was actually active in the sphere of climate and environmentalism in this position. What do you think you're going to do differently so that Israel is able to meet its targets long term?
So you are right. And I think the state controller's report from last week show that Israel is way behind and did not do much for many, many years. And I'm actually proud to say that in this government 4 months, we already are doing more than has been done for years. As I mentioned, in July, we adopted a government decision for our targets, and our prime minister declared that we will update our targets very soon. 3 months later, just last week, before a week before going to Glasgow, we adopted another series of four government decisions in fields of energy, of transportation, of innovation. They are budgeted. They have the allocation in the budget, and they are planned, and some of them are already in progress. So yes, we are doing much more. And we also know that it's only the beginning. We still have much more to do. We have to legislate a climate law. We have to invest more in the direction of innovation. We have, like we said, to move from fossil fuels to renewables. So we still have much to do, but I'm excited to report that we are, for the first time maybe ever in the history of Israel, we are in the right direction.
So moving back to Scotland, I know you had a bunch of meetings with your foreign counterparts. Could you tell me about some of them and sort of what came up in those meetings?
Yes, I met with many. Like, for example, I joined Prime Minister Bennett in his meetings with the Prime Minister of Australia and with the Minister in charge for emission reduction. And we discussed cooperations in the fields of innovation and technology. And they have a national fund that we are interested in cooperating with. I met with some representatives of our region in the Middle East, for example, the minister from Cyprus, that have an initiative to develop means to fight climate change adaptation in ways that are fit for the climate in the Middle East. You know, we speak with our counterparts in Europe and in other places, but here in the Middle East, we share the climate and we share the challenges. So this is a very important cooperation. I also met with professionals, for example, the deputy of the special envoy Kerry for the climate of the White House to discuss some great developments on investments. For example, he told me that there are $85 billion around the world waiting for investments in innovation, which is something that is very interesting for Israel. And with the head of the International Energy Agency, that has very interesting predictions about how the oil and gas prices that we see going up are very, very temporary. And he made it very clear that the world is looking at renewables and is not going back from there. So it would be very risky to invest in new investments in oil and gas.
That's an interesting point. Why does he think then that we're having all these issues with energy, not in Israel so much, but in Europe and in the US, and the price is going up so much?
Because this is his business, you know. He looks at the world, he looks at the demand, he looks at the directions, at the commitments and the plans that different countries are making. And he understands, and he says that the prices rise is very, very temporary, and maybe even not necessary, and it happens because of reasons that has to do not directly with the markets, but with other issues that are around them, like political issues and others. And he's very, very clear that the direction is only towards renewables. And if anyone thinks that Europe and the world is going to forget about renewables and return to coal and gas, this is not going to happen.
In Europe, there's a push, especially from France, I've seen, for nuclear energy. Is that something Israel could ever consider?
I think that the Middle East does not look at nuclear right now. I know it's an interesting technology in the world. I think we are not there at the moment. We do have solar technologies that are already very, very available, very, very in use. And we have some obstacles that we have to get over, not in terms of technology, but in terms of the grid, in terms of bureaucracy, legislation, regulation.
Well, storage is also a big issue, right? The technology doesn't really exist to scale solar up to the degree we'd need it.
No, it does exist. It does exist. You are right that this is a very growing field in terms of innovation. There is the technology to use at least 50% of the to meet the target of 2030 already exists today. So that would be a mistake to wait for future technologies and do nothing in the meantime, because a lot of the technology does exist. You are right that storage is a huge issue for solar because the sun only shines half the day. Some technologies already exist, and of course they will develop. They will develop more in the future. But even now, we don't have to wait. I mean, we can supply at least 50% of the demand during the day and with the existing technologies of storage even today. So it's not an excuse to do nothing.
Okay. Israel signed on to this deforestation pledge to not do any deforestation. And Israel is famously a country that I believe the only country in the world that finished the 20th century with more trees than how it started the 20th century. But now we are, you know, well into the 21st century. So what does this deforestation pledge mean for Israel, a country that, you know, plants a lot of trees, actually?
Yes. First of all, it is true that we adopted the pledge. We are proud of it. We also adopted the pledge to reduce 30% of methane by the end of the decade. So this is also something new in Israeli environmental policy, that we joined the international pledges and we mean to meet them. The deforestation pledge is actually about conserving the natural ecosystem, which is a huge part of climate change. It's not just about energy and renewables and reducing the emissions. It's also about preparing and adapting to climate change that will happen for sure, even if we stop emitting greenhouse gases today. The gas that already exists in the atmosphere will for sure cause climate changes and disasters even that we have to face. And conserving the natural ecosystems, like the sea, like the open spaces, like the ecological corridors, like the biodiversity, is extremely important, because this is the ecosystems that provide the natural services for humanity to live. So the pledge is about not only the forests, meaning by trees, because we also we do plant trees, but we also build a lot, and we also have to make sure that we don't deforest some of the trees that exist. But the pledge also means that we commit to 30% protected areas, like natural reserves, for example, in Israel by the end of the decade. And I must say that the level of nature conservation in Israel is very high, because the legislation of nature reserves that provide very high quality protection. I mean, if we compare it to other countries. So, and we have to keep this effort and protect open spaces from efforts of from development, for example, and you know, which is also an issue in Israel because we have a growing population. So we have to manage our resources very, very smartly, so we can protect nature, that is a huge part of adapting to climate change.
So one last question before I let you go. You told me actually that you had run into U.S. President Biden. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And of course, there's a picture of him whispering in your ear. So what did he say?
Yes. So yes, I did run into him. You know, this is an amazing thing about conferences like that, that you just walk in the corridor and you run into, you know, Theresa May and President Biden and Prince Charles. And you know, everybody are there, and this is, I think, it's also an answer to all those who ask, why don't you meet up in Zoom, you know? And I think there is a strength and there is a huge power to the conference that exceeds way beyond the carbon print of flying there. Yes, I did come up to President Biden and I shook his hand and I thanked him for his leadership on climate and in general, and his friendship for Israel. He was very, very kind and very, very friendly. And he whispered to my ear, if Israel didn't exist, you have to invent it. So I took it with me, and I think that's something to work with here, and to know that when fighting climate change, you also protect our beloved country and land, and that's a good enough reason to do it.
Well, that is a great message to end this interview. So thank you so much for being on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Sure, thank you.
Next, we have Michael Schallenberger, the author of the book Apocalypse Never, here with the Jerusalem Post to talk about why the solutions to climate change that we hear about all the time are not the right ones.
I'd like to welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast Michael Schallenberger, the author of the book Apocalypse Never, which is now available in Hebrew and Israel as well. It's a book that came out last year that talks about climate change, but also why alarmism about climate change is not helpful. And I want to give our listeners a little bit of a different perspective than what I think we usually hear about climate change in the media. I certainly am not a climate expert, but here I am at this climate conference, and I wanted to learn and get other perspectives. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You talk a lot about how the sort of accepted or commonly discussed solutions for climate change are problematic. Could you tell us a little about which solutions you're talking about and why? Well, what's wrong with them?
Sure. Well, just as background, I've been working on climate change and energy and environmental issues for 25 years. In the early 2000s, I started a labor environment coalition to advocate for renewables. But as we started to scale them up, we started to discover pretty big land use impacts. It takes about 300 times more land to generate the same amount of electricity from a solar farm as it does from a nuclear or natural gas plant. A number of friends of mine were like, you got to take a second look at nuclear. And last year published Apocalypse Never, which really is the culmination of 20 years of research. And you know what you find is that the big emissions reductions that we've seen, including in the United States over the last 15 years, have come from the switch from coal to natural gas, and to some extent from nuclear as well. Germany, France, and Britain saw their emissions peak in the mid-70s from switching from coal to gas and nuclear. The United States saw its emissions decline by 22%, which is 5 percentage points more than it had promised to under the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. So really, in these two technologies is a pretty straightforward and cost-effective way to reduce emissions. Both are pretty actively opposed by the people who say they're really concerned about climate change. Fracking for natural gas was demonized, even though it's been the big driver of emissions reductions in the United States. And of course, nuclear power is something that, you know, not just Greens, but really the United Nations and many other liberal-minded or center-left people have opposed for a really long time.
And so I think natural gas is for Israelis, is the especially, I think, relevant issue, because there were huge gas discoveries in Israel's economic waters in the Mediterranean. And we're en route to get rid of coal use entirely and really to move mostly to natural gas. And yet we're now being sort of discouraged from natural gas and being told that by 2050 we shouldn't be using that either. So why do you think that natural gas is better?
Well, I mean, just the physics of it. I mean, natural gas produces half the carbon emissions as coal. It also doesn't degrade landscapes. You know, it obviously comes from underground, so you don't have to destroy whole mountaintops like you do with coal. In terms of carbon emissions, there's basically, in terms of going to zero, you have basically three major choices: nuclear, solar, or wind. Problem with solar and wind is that they are not reliable. In fact, Germany saw its emissions rise 25% the first half of this year because the wind just didn't blow very much. We've actually in the middle of an energy crisis globally because we spent too much money on unreliable solar and wind, and we didn't spend enough money on oil and gas exploration or nuclear. Hydroelectric dams, they exist in the tropical parts of the world that haven't yet developed, but there's really not much more damming to be done in the Western world and the developed world. So, yeah, I mean, the idea that Israel would somehow just switch to solar requires a pretty big leap of imagination. I mean, the idea, the fantasy was always, you know, solar panels and batteries, but it's really expensive. Batteries are just really expensive. You have to import all your lithium to make them. They make electricity expensive. And also, it doesn't work across seasons. In fact, it only usually works for a few minutes or hours a day. So batteries are not an option. solar panels are made cheap in China using basically incarcerated Uyghur Muslim labor, cheap coal, and government subsidies, all three of which are now in at threat. One of them for human rights reasons, obviously, mm-hmm. the Muslims. But coal is now expensive again, thanks to the energy crisis, and it was never a great way to make solar panels. And Chinese government subsidies are coming to an end. So really, we're dealing with the energy crisis and the failure of climate talks, which kind of failed before they began because, you know, the countries could not agree on even stop financing coal plants. President Xi from China is not coming to the talks. Putin is not coming to the talks. They didn't go to the G20 talks before that. So really, UN climate talks are in disarray in part because people just haven't gotten real about the fundamental failings of renewables, the inability for renewables to power society, and the unwillingness to embrace natural gas and nuclear.
One of the big things you talked about in the book is that the developing world still needs to catch up in so many ways, and it's not really able to do that when it has if it starts moving to all of these renewables, all these things that the Western world are moving to, that they won't be able to, you know, cheaply get electricity to all of their people and things like that. Could you, I guess, elaborate a little on how these plans are impacting the developed world, the developing world?
Sure. Well, one of the case studies in Apocalypse Never is the Congo. This is a country that could, the most obvious thing for them to do is dam the Congo River and construct big hydroelectric dams. That's how Brazil lifted itself out of poverty. It's how the United States did it, many parts of Europe. But it's opposed by really first world rich people who don't want to see the Congo develop. And they make up reasons for that. But basically, it's been an anti-development constituency at the UN since World War II. Really, these are people that repeat the ideas of Thomas Malthus, the idea that the world's going to run out of resources when it became clear that population growth rates had peaked, you know, and that also I think the United Nations had mission drift after the end of the Cold War, when the threat of nuclear war declined after the end of the Cold War, after it became clear that we weren't going to have overpopulation, which everybody feared. Then the concern shifted to climate change, and now climate is used as reason to justify basically not allowing poor countries to get natural gas or hydroelectric dams or nuclear power plants like the kinds that we have in the rich world. And the justification used to be, well, we're going to use up all the resources. And now it tends to be climate change, even though often the power plants that they want don't produce any carbon emissions.
So you mentioned Malthusian economics and how there was once a fear that there was, you know, going to be more people on Earth than the Earth could support. And a lot of climate activists are still sort of, some of them call themselves anti-natalists. They think people shouldn't be bringing children into the world because there shouldn't be more people in this world. What do you say to that?
I think it's really sad and depressing. You know, it's basically anti-humanism. I think it stems from depression. And so does these apocalyptic visions. I mean, there's nothing in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that suggests that climate change will be the end of the world or the end of civilization. In fact, it doesn't even predict an increase in deaths from natural disasters or disease or any of the other things that they talk about because we continue to adapt so well. So I think that this anti-human agenda has really motivated a lot of this advocacy, not all of it, but certainly too much of it. And there's just not any truth to it. I mean, actually, the biggest concern now among demographers is that, you know, countries aren't having enough people.
Right.
You know, we're actually just experiencing negative population growth in a number of European countries. So, yeah, I think it doesn't come from a good place. And I think it's had some pretty negative consequences, including the lack of necessary investment in reliable energy sources, but also in things like, you know, modern agriculture for poor countries where people are looking to escape subsistence farming, not make it more sustainable.
So you've been pretty down on COP26, on this climate conference that's happening now. Is there anything positive that you think will come out of this?
You know, it's not bad to allow nations to brag about what they're doing to take action on climate change. I think some amount of competition, which is basically what it is, since none of it's binding, it's basically an exercise in just showing people what you're doing. You know, I just think it goes wrong when they, you know, they misattribute the reduction of emissions in rich countries to these policies. It's mostly just the result of expanded oil and gas production and building nuclear power stations. It's not the result of UN diplomats negotiating, you know, non-binding treaties. And then I think the other problem is then, you know, really the, because rich countries are going to be fine. They're not going to run out of energy. They're not going to allow themselves to. The people that end up getting hurt the most are the vulnerable, you know, poor nations of sub-Saharan Africa, which have seen basically wealthy countries cut off funding for things like oil and gas projects or hydroelectric dams that they really desperately need to climb out of poverty.
Yeah. It's a very complex issue. It seems like, and it's more complex than the sort of, you know, slogans and announcements that you hear from the conference. They really don't reflect sort of all of the sides. And so I want to thank you for giving us that additional perspective and the details about climate change that we often don't hear about. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was a delight.
Thank you so much for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please share with your friends. We're available on all major podcast platforms, and we will be back next week.